Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I am so thrilled to be sitting across Zoom today from Scott Sauls, author, pastor, speaker, encourager in this season, really. Hey, Scott.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Alexis.
Thank you so much. I told him right before we started recording that I literally just finished his brand new book. And by the time this airs, it won't be brand new anymore. It'll still be a baby, I guess, about 6 months old. But it's called A Gentle Answer, Our Secret Weapon in an Age of Us Against Them. Mm-hmm. And Scott, I want to say we're recording this in at the very, very end of October, so less than a week before the election. And some of my girlfriends and I have a little group text going. There's everything from, you know, yesterday someone sent out an encouraging political article. Then sometimes we have recipes, or someone will send a devotional for parenting. And I, as soon as I finished this book, snapped a picture of the cover and sent it and said, by the way, this is golden.
Oh,
I just finished it.
So
grab a copy of this book. But I want to ask you kind of to start off, where did this come from? Because it feels so timely right now, but I'm like, I know you didn't sit down in February when the virus hit and thought, oh, I think I'll write something. Or in May when the protest started and said, you know what, things feel a little contentious right now. I think I'll release something right before the summer before this crazy election time. So where did this come from?
Yeah, so great question. A couple of places, really. I mean, this has been the theme of A Gentle Answer in a climate of hostility and polarization has been a real theme that we've emphasized in our ministry at the church that I lead in Nashville, Christ Presbyterian Church, and also in my writing. I started writing books. I'm sort of an accidental author. And, you know, my first book, I've got five out now, which is just kind of crazy to imagine. But my first one is a book called Jesus Outside the Lines, which is in many ways an unintentional companion to this newest book, A Gentle Answer. A Gentle Answer is more about, you know, cultivating gentleness in our hearts in response to what's going on in the culture around us, and especially in response to how Christ, you know, the one who described himself as the one who is gentle and humble in heart, has treated us and has responded to our, you know, hostility, rebellion, ambivalence, indifference to him with gentleness and kindness. And so the two triggers, I guess, for A Gentle Answer three triggers, really. One is, this is a theme that I've been has been a special focus for me personally over the last almost decade. And then also the other two, which is really where my headspace was a couple of years ago when we conceived the project, was, number one, the 2016 election year was kind of horrible and contentious. And, you know, we were thinking, well, this book will release sometime in 2020, which will be the next round. And what if we put something out there that might help move the needle in a direction of more kindness? And the third trigger was the renewed popularity of Mr. Rogers, which was happening about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
And I grew up loving Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
You know, he's the friend that I never met. You know, we were at a Q conference, this conference I was, you know, speaking at and participating in. And one of the special evening events that they had was a premiere of the new documentary on Mr. Rogers. And my wife, Patty, and I were just taken by that. And then, you know, the Hollywood film starring Tom Hanks was released and it was wonderful. And so there's just sort of this renewed love and affection for not just Mr. Rogers, but for everything that he represents, especially in this climate. And I think that the popularity of both of those films is really an indicator of where our culture is right now. I personally think there's a silent majority that craves kindness and gentleness infinitely more than hostility and polarization. But I think so many people just feel stuck and don't know how to get out of the polarization. And so a general answer, I kind of wrote the book hoping it could be a bit of a guide, you know, to direct us toward a more healthy way of being and way of thinking and living and way of responding to the climate around us. I think it's a great opportunity right now, especially for Christians, to be counterculture, not in a negative, demeaning way, but in a positive, life-giving way by responding with, you know, fruit of the Spirit, beatitudes, posture, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because when you say the term silent majority, it's like gentleness is not loud. Right? Like kindness doesn't get attention. When I was prepping for our time together today, one of your, I think you maybe have reposted an article that you wrote a couple of years ago with referring to the woman who tweeted something that ruined her career. And, but she had apologized before it. And you mentioned in that, like, but apologies don't make the news, right? Like these types of responses, and even the initiation of kindness and gentleness isn't loud and it isn't flamboyant and it isn't attention grabbing. Right. But I say that and I say, it's not attention grabbing unless you're the one who needs the gentleness.
That's right. Boy, what a great insight, Alexis. When you're the one who needs it, it really does grab you. You know, one of the things that has sparked curiosity in people who, you know, I've had conversations about the book with, who haven't actually read the book, like you, which is fine. I don't expect everybody to read the book. People got a lot of books, you know, to read, but those who haven't read it have been intrigued and a little bit confused by the title of the fifth chapter, which is Gentle People Do Anger Well.
Yes.
You know, the question, which is a really good question, how do anger and gentleness go together? Well, you know, I talk in the chapter about, you know, the difference between righteous anger and raging anger. You know, anger is a lot like fire. It always seeks to destroy something, you know, but fire destroying bacteria in food is a good thing. Fire destroying, you know, a trash heap is a good thing. Fire, you know, destroying toxins and poisonous things and viruses is a really good thing. But fire, you know, taking over the coast of, you know, the West Coast is not a good thing, right? So there's a raging fire, which is like the West Coast fires, or, you know, This Is Us premiere is, you know, just came out last night, right? We're all still grieved, those of us who watch This Is Us, that a house fire killed Jack. So there's a raging fire and there's a righteous fire, in the same way that anger can be a raging anger. And raging anger is the kind of anger that attacks people. Righteous anger is the kind of anger that attacks problems. Problems like injustice, problems like illness, problems like homelessness and poverty. The question isn't, are you angry? We ought to be angry. If we're following Jesus fully, we're going to get angry about some stuff. We're going to get angry about anything that attacks or compromises that which is good, and anything that diminishes flourishing, we're going to get upset about. You know, C.S. Lewis once said that Christianity is a fighting religion. Mm-hmm. You know, Christians go into the world when they're at their best. Christians go into the world and they're awake at all the problems that are there in the world, and they seek to create and build solutions to those problems. You know, King was angry about racial injustice, right? And yet he didn't attack people. He attacked the problem. And in attacking the problem instead of people, some of the people who are actually part of the problem, were won over to his side to attack the problem of racial inequality with him, right? And so you see how it works. There's a great scene in the Bible in Luke chapter 7 where Jesus gets infuriated with some Pharisees who are bullying a prostitute who comes in and, you know, basically uses the tools of her trade, her hair, her lips, and her perfume, to demonstrate affection to Jesus by washing his feet and anointing his feet and wiping them with her hair and her tears. And the self-righteous, smug religious people, they scorn her. They look down on her. They cancel her, right? They don't even acknowledge her personhood. They treat her like a thing instead of a person. You know, they call her a sinner. And that's her identity in their eyes. And Jesus turns to them, you know, to your point. Gentleness grabs our attention when we're the recipients. He gets aggressive with the bullies and essentially says, if you're going to get to her, you've got to go through me first. And if you go through me, you're going to lose. You're not going to get to her through me. And you know, Matt, we so are focused sometimes on passages like that about, look at how Jesus stuck it to those Pharisees. But meanwhile, he's also tenderly protecting and reminding this woman of her dignity as he is standing up for her and demonstrating her worth, that he would stand up for her. Is it actually his act of aggression and anger to shut down the bullies is actually an act of gentleness for her. And so, you know, the Pharisees and the woman experience him in very different ways in that moment. But, you know, to your point, when we're the recipients, we really notice.
Right. I mean, I loved that section of the book because I never thought when you used that phrase that she used the tools of her trade, like mm-hmm. she used what she had, yeah. you know, and I think like you tell a story in the book when you're talking about, I think it's when you're talking about Nathaniel, and it's like, we don't know what Jesus saw. Something struck him. We don't know what he saw. And you kind of give some, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, some kind of some possibilities. What did Jesus mm-hmm. see him doing? And years ago when I was younger, we were traveling quite a bit, and I would see people in the airport, right? Just kind of people watching. And I would lean over to my husband and I would say, oh my goodness, this is so beautiful. The story I made up. The story yeah, I made yeah. up about this scene, or the story I made up about this person is such and such, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we can make up stories in our heads mm-hmm. to fit a narrative that we have, but then remembering that Jesus is the only one who really knows that full narrative. You know, when I was growing up in church and hearing stories about Rahab, right, who we see in Hebrews 11 at the end, I couldn't, for the life of me, I couldn't bring everything together. She was a prostitute for a living. She was lying about the situation. She was, you know, I couldn't bring all of this together. But kind of that wording, the tools of the trade, reminded me that Jesus has, I don't even know how to say it in a way that will fully describe what I'm trying to communicate, but I feel like it's a reminder that Jesus has an amount of grace and compassion for where we are in the moment. And so mm-hmm. words that I got for this a few years ago was, if I could just focus on other people and say to myself, we're all doing the best we can with what we have. Mm-hmm. And if we really believed that about one another, then I think we'd be in a better position to be angry at the problem, or be angry at the idea, or be angry at the action, instead of being attacking of the person. Maybe if we came to them and we thought in our heads, mm-hmm. this person is doing the best she can mm-hmm. with what she has, right? Like yeah. you said, with Dr. King, these people who were part of the problem, maybe they were doing the best they could with what they had, but when they had more, and he gave them more through his mm-hmm. gentleness and kindness and education and compassion, he was able right. to give them more, then they could respond in a better way.
Right. That's right. And that's
it doesn't always happen that way. And so I'm kind of hoping you'll take us there next, maybe, because you talk a lot about each of us. A theme throughout the book, I feel like, is each of us are simultaneously sinner and saint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We all have it in us. We all have an inner Jesus, you say at one point, and we all have an inner Judas. Okay. And sometimes it's a moment that makes the difference. Sometimes it's a lapse of judgment. Sometimes it's a moment. Can you talk us through that concept and how this idea of gentleness can help us navigate those spheres in ourselves and in the people that we interact with?
So, you know, the book starts, the first three chapters, just trying to drill it in to our hearts. This is Jesus's posture toward us. This is our starting point with the one who would have every right to crush us if he desired to, and has chosen instead to redeem us and to restore us and forgive us and make us new. And the way that he describes himself is as the one who is gentle and humble in heart, and the response that invites in us is to enter into rest. You know, he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened." And a lot of times what we're most weary and what we're most burdened with is our own shame and our own guilt and our own regret. We try to work our own guilt and shame and regret. I think this was the psychology of the Pharisees. We try to work out our own guilt and shame and regret, either through performance or by deflecting our guilt, shame, and regret on other people, like the Pharisees did in Luke chapter 7 on the prostitute. Like, if I can find somebody who looks worse than me and make them the focus, then I won't have to deal. That's a way that I can sort of self-medicate my own guilt and my own shame and my own regret. I mean, it's right there in Luke 18:9 when Jesus...
I was going to say he's beating his chest, right?
Right before he gives a parable to the tax collector and the Pharisee. Good job. You know Luke 18. You know your Bible.
I just looked at it. This week.
how wonderful. So you remember how Luke set up the parable. He says, to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and looked down on other people with contempt, Jesus told this parable, and then he gives a parable to the Pharisee and tax collector, and that's the inner heart working. That's the psychology of cancel culture, the psychology of shutdown culture, the psychology of why the internet mob would go on the attack against the woman that you mentioned, Justine Sacco, right? There are articles about her out there. She lost her entire career. Not because she said something racist, but because something she said was interpreted as racist when actually she was attempting to self-deprecate, and she was actually attempting to, in a kind of a snarky way, to point out that there is racial inequality in the world and that she does have privilege because she's a white woman. Like, that's what she was actually trying to say. But the internet mob would not accept her own explanation of her own statement. And the reason why we want to create false narratives, why we want to take, words and phrases out of somebody else's, whoever the enemy is or whoever the other is, we want to cherry pick something they said, take it entirely out of their context. And by the way, this is exactly what the Pharisees tried to do to Jesus all the time. Mm-hmm. Just take something he said, pull it entirely out of its context, and then construct a completely false slander narrative, and then go on the and then gather some groupies and then mob the person in order to try to destroy them. And it's called character assassination. And the Pharisees had to do that in order to feel better about themselves. Now, here's the alternative that the gospel offers. Enter into Jesus's rest. Mm-hmm. And part of what it means to enter into Jesus's rest is that you get to medicate your own shame and your own guilt and your own regret, but in a different way. The medicine comes from Jesus, who's the physician, who says, we're going to get real about your guilt and your shame, and you're going to name it. And where you don't name it and where you don't own it, I'm going to help you name it. And I'm going to help you own it, not because I want to attack you or destroy you, but because I want to mend you. I want to heal you. And part of the healing, and this is true with our physical bodies, right? We have to acknowledge the lump under our armpit. Mm-hmm. We have to acknowledge, you know, the pain in our foot, or we have to acknowledge the fatigue we have. And if we keep pushing through, you know, the cancer cells are going to continue to multiply and eventually destroy us. But if you can, you know, the earlier, you know, we can submit our own flaws and our own weaknesses and shortcomings to Jesus, you know, the earlier you catch it, right? The quicker the healing and the better the life. But man, guilt, shame, and regret are such powerful forces. And we have to remember that there is an enemy who is preaching a counter gospel to us all the time, who wants us to deal with our guilt and our shame and our regret by hiding, and the way we hide is by deflecting, by criticizing other people and so on, as opposed to bringing it into the light, which is what Jesus offers. I mean, how liberated would we be if we felt like we really could be exposed and not rejected, that we really could be completely known and completely loved at the same time. And that's what Jesus offers. The problem is that our pride and ironically our self-loathing, which we want to hang on to for some twisted reason, gets in the way of us simply receiving open-handed what Jesus has to offer in himself. So I don't know if that answers your question. I'm sorry, I don't even remember the question you asked.
No, it's good.
But we got to run to Christ. We got to run to Christ. Like, you can't get to gentleness. You can't get to any of the fruit of the Spirit by going around Christ. Like, there's no bypass road around Jesus to get to the virtues of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. The only way to become like Jesus in those things is to stop exerting your effort to be like Jesus in those things. And instead, invest your effort in being with Jesus.
Say that last part again.
Stop exerting yourself to try to be good, because you don't have it in you. None of us has it in us to be, you know, fruit of the Spirit people: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. We don't have what it takes to become those things by going around Jesus to get to them, right? Just like the Pharisees couldn't get to the prostitute without going through Jesus, we can't get to virtue without going to Jesus. We can't get to the fruit of the Spirit without going through Jesus. So invest your energy in knowing Christ, knowing who you are in Christ, in being with Christ, and then you become like Christ, right? You know, Christ rubs off, right?
Yes.
He rubs off. You know, let's say this: like, the fruit of the Spirit's like a virus. It's like, you know, medical people talk about communicable viruses and incommunicable viruses. The incommunicable virus is the ones that it's the one you can't pass to other people. They can't catch it. You're not contagious. God has some incommunicable attributes, right? He's omniscient. He knows everything. He's omnipotent. He's all powerful. He's omnipresent. He's everywhere all the time. So those attributes are not passed on to us. But he also has communicable attributes: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. And so we got to ask ourselves, how do we get a communicable virus? We get close.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a viral kind of year in 2020. Yes. as we record this. You know, we're social distancing, right? So we don't get the virus. We have to socially undistance ourselves from Christ in order to catch those things, to inhale his breath, right? The Holy Spirit is also the breath of God, to receive his kiss, right? Which is, you know, baptism, the Lord's Supper, communion, fellowship with other believers, and so on, to to get close to him, to eat and drink after him. You know, all of these things, we want to catch what Jesus has got. And the only way that you can catch what somebody's got is proximity.
Yeah.
Nearness, fellowship, yeah. Love, intimacy.
Yeah. No, that's good. Can you tell the story of, cause it was something that was, it felt so tender. And I thought, I feel like it's going to take us there, but I don't necessarily want to go there. And then I read it. And it was almost the same thing. So what I mentioned before was this simultaneous sinner and saintness. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can tell the story of when you were talking with your friends at dinner about Andrea Yates. Mm-hmm. And not everybody may know who she is. So if mm-hmm. we can say that I don't even know how to say it, but yeah, if you can talk about Andrea Yates and then this conversation that you had at dinner with your friends.
Yeah. So we're at dinner with some friends. Andrea Yates is a woman who killed her children. She just had a moment of just, you know, coming to the end of herself, you know, with stress and feeling overwhelmed. And she has several small children, and one by one, she drowned them in their bathtub, and was convicted and put in jail. And, you know, later on, it was, you know, discovered that she had a mental illness and all of these things. But she's in jail for life for doing that. And sometimes shortly after that happened, and it made the news, we're in our small group. Our church small group, and we're going around just kind of thinking, oh my goodness, like how does that happen? How does somebody get to a point where they would kill their own children and then keep killing their children after one and another and another and another? And one of the women in the group who was actually one of the moms that everybody looked up to, she said, I could do that. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what?
Right.
And she said, you put me in the right set of circumstances with the right amount of sleep deprivation and the right amount of stress. I know it's in me. I've felt mm-hmm. those things. I have felt murderous thoughts mm-hmm. Toward my own children mm-hmm. in those moments. And then it just kind of the light bulb went on for all of us. And we're like, me too. you know, mm-hmm. like, is it safe to say that those things are in me as well? And it, you know, turned out that this was a group where it was safe to say those things. And it's true. I mean, Jesus, why are we surprised that anybody would say that, right? When Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, look, if you have any amount of hate in your heart for anyone, you've already murdered them. You've already got murderous intent. You've got that thing in you.
Yes.
That leads people to do stuff like that. And if you were put in the same set of conditions, you probably would have done the same thing. It's essentially what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, right? And so we need grace. We need Jesus. That's the conclusion. We all need him.
That's actually how. So I kind of joke sometimes in my former life before becoming a mother and moving to Texas and all of this. I was working in a child welfare setting, right? So I'm working with families who have been seriously affected by child abuse and neglect. And this was a state agency, a largely secular environment. But I couldn't have been more thankful, because while it did, kind of like you're saying with this woman, it really struck me as odd at first. How I was introduced to my job was this. One of my kind of senior supervisors basically said to me, we have to remember that each of us are one decision away from being where our clients are right now. And I kind of thought, like what kind of, you know, the shock factor of what you guys experienced that night initially in your home. But the other part of that is to say, number one, we have to recognize that it's in us, like you just mentioned. But I think the part that you speak about so eloquently in your book is to say, but the point that they were making in my job was we have to treat each other as if we believe that to be true, right? So if I'm only one bad decision away from being where my client is, then I have to treat her with the same dignity and respect and compassion that I would want to be treated if I were in her position. So when we see someone who has committed the sin that we can't even speak of, or when they say something that we think, I can't fathom that ever coming out of someone's mouth. If we think to ourselves, how would I want someone to respond to me if I had just said that or done that or been in that position or whatever, it changes us and it has potential to change them too, right? I mean, I just felt that that's the second, kind of the second part of your book, right? Jesus has responded to us in this way. Now, how do we internalize that and respond to others with that same kind of gentleness?
Yeah, the Apostle Paul lays that very thing out in the early chapters of Romans, where he gives this whole list in Romans 1 of all the, you know, the debased, you know, evil things that are coming out of the human heart and being, you know, spilled out into the world. And then his conclusion is, you know, he's talking about the wrath of God and how it's poured out on this and this and this and this. And then he says at the end, and what about us? Are we any better? Absolutely not. And yeah, in other words, you know, be really careful when you get prophetic about something. Like, the prophetic gift is a gift that God gives us, you know, to call out things that shouldn't be. But we must never grow beyond the reality that we are so capable of that we are so capable of the very things that we critique. And you know, give you an example. Our daughter went to a school, you know, here in Nashville, and you know, when, I'll probably upset some people when I say this, but like there are a few things that are more perplexing than kind of the woke white person who decides they want to be a prophet, and yet they've paid no personal price or cost for their message. And so our daughter is part of a school that, you know, basically when Blackout Tuesday and all the marches started to happen, there was this letter, like this, you know, like attacking the school for not being advanced enough on, you know, race related issues. And, you know, some pretty vicious things were said in this letter, and it was like signed by, you know, X number of alumni, right? And meanwhile, behind the scenes, the school has actually hired outside consultants and for 3 years has been doing an internal audit on, you know, racial sensitivity and racial justice and cultural intelligence and empathy. And they've, like, 3 years have been really working hard at, you know, becoming a truly, you know, empathetic, multicultural, you know, context, right? Still imperfect, but really, you know, giving it the best effort possible, you know, minority consultants coming in from the outside and all of that. And so there's this letter that's written, right? And so we sit down with our daughter and we're like, let's scroll through a few Instagram feeds and let's see if we can find any non-white people, you know, in the Instagram feeds. And we went through one angry white woke student after another. And I think we stopped after about a dozen Instagram accounts. We couldn't find a single ethnic minority in any of the pictures of all of these, you know, prophetic white woke people, you know, whose message, you know, might have some real validity to it in terms of how things might have been, you know, when they were at this school. But our daughter then turns to us and says, you know, and our daughter is, you know, she's very, you know, personally invested in matters of justice and has been for years, ever since she was in junior high. You know, she's a child of New York City and, you know, very invested in, you know, all things diversity and, you know, giving her life to, you know, the cause of Middle Eastern refugees and that kind of thing. So like she's in the headspace and always has been. And she says, you know, I can't sign this petition, even though there were some issues when I was school, I can't sign this petition. Because as I look down the list, the people that are criticizing the problem actually were the problem. when we were in school, they were actually the racists. They were actually the ones who were creating an uncomfortable environment for minority students. And you know, just the point being, that's just a long, circuitous, you know, anecdote to say that before we name a problem and call out a problem, we've got to be pretty certain that we're not actually part of the problem first. You know, Jesus talked about logs and specks, right? And he says, you know, before you presume to remove a speck from somebody else's eye. And of course, Alexis, if you see a speck in my eye, it's a mercy for you to help me remove it, right? Because that can lead to infection and I could go blind, you know, worst case scenario. So it's not about, you know, you shouldn't ever try to remove a speck from somebody's eye. You should never try to correct somebody else. It's not about that. But Jesus says, you got to deal with a log in your own eye first. In other words, when we go into these situations, we've got to go in regarding ourselves as hypocrite number one. And just think if everybody approached conflict that way, where they're looking at themselves before they're looking at those that they're criticizing, I mean, it'd be a wonderful climate relationally, wouldn't it? But we so often want to think, well, the log is in somebody else's eye. And if I have anything in mind, it's just a speck. So let's deal with the problem out there.
No, I wanted you to talk about that a little bit more because there was a part in one of the sections in your book, and I don't remember what chapter it was in, but you were talking about taking criticism and that we should all be able to take it. We should all try and accept it when it is grounded, but that even when it's not, that we should be able to posture ourselves to accept some of that. And I wish I didn't have a recent example from my own life where I felt like God really led me to do that, where, you know, it was something was said and there were some interactions and I just thought, there's actually nothing about this that's true. But I was up at 4:30 in the morning involuntarily for the next week or two because I really felt God's spirit pulling me to say, help me address and say, maybe that's not true, but what is, right?
Wow.
Because just because that thing may not have been true doesn't mean I could come out of that completely unscathed with nothing to learn from the situation. And so, like I said, I wish I hadn't just recently had to kind of deal with that. But how do you, can you just talk a little bit about that aspect of it? Because it is so easy, like you're saying, and like the Gospels, Jesus tells us in the Gospels to want to just say, if you just hold still, I'll just grab that real quick and we'll be done. I'll just get it out of your eye. I'll get it out of your space. But what do we do when someone tries to grab it and we're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, how do we address that in our own lives? Because that's key to how we can interact with others.
Yeah. So Tim Keller, who I, you know, served with for several years in New York. He's remarkable at this personally. And there's a whole anecdote that I'll just tease your listeners with. They can read about Tim in the book that they want of just a wonderful shining example of the way that he really lives this out. But But he says we should always, be circumspect when we receive a criticism, even an unfair criticism. He says we've got to resist the urge to go on the attack. We've got to resist the urge to try to shame, embarrass, put the other person in their place. Don't become cynical, and don't become a canceler, right? Mm-hmm. He says, look, even when, and he openly acknowledges, he says, look, most of the criticism that he receives, he says, is for having views and positions that he actually doesn't hold. It's people cherry picking things out of context and creating a narrative, like we talked about, a few minutes ago. Some people call him a cultural Marxist, like so far left because of his emphasis on the poor and justice. And some people call him a right-wing conservative because of his position on, gender and marriage and, things like that. And so, so he's going to take the hits. Right. And so he says, and he learned this from John Newton, who's the pastor who wrote Amazing Grace. Right. And John Newton has this series of letters that he wrote to young ministers. And one of the letters that John Newton wrote to a young minister was called On Controversy. And it's about when you receive unfair criticism. And Newton says that when you are criticized unfairly, it's always best to look for a kernel of truth that might be in that criticism, so you can have something to take to the Lord, ask for forgiveness and grace and receive it. It becomes a gospel opportunity, even in an unfair criticism. Another person that I love on this is a guy named Jack Miller, who was from, from Pennsylvania. He's a pastor and a seminary professor and really deep, deep awareness of the grace of Christ, and just walked as a forgiven man, just lived his life as a forgiven man through years and years of formation in those identity statements of who we are in Christ. And when he was unfairly criticized, his standard response was, you don't even know the half of it. And
that was my favorite.
and B, thank you for not verbalizing the reality of how bad it really is. thank you for only going that far. I don't recognize myself in a number of the things that you're saying here, but at least I'm thankful that what you're saying isn't nearly as bad as it actually is. and there's just this disarming thing about that. I mean, you want to shut a critic down. It's not going to be through shouting over them. It's going to be through saying, I don't necessarily agree with that, but there are 10 other things that if you knew about those 10 other things, you'd know that you've just let me off the hook in reality, And so that takes, though, a lot, again, of, back to the thing that we were talking about a few minutes ago. It again points out how much we need to be with Christ and receive the resources of Christ, to form our hearts, to be ready for those moments, to be spiritually ready for those moments, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. sorry, real life.
No worries.
My dog was, anyway, call the 8-year-old and come grab her out. This is the everybody's at home on different
days. Gotcha. Understand.
Here. But no, I loved that, that example of you don't know the half of it, and I just think about us being in relationship with one another as the body of Christ. It's like, this is going to be good for our own personal spiritual formation, our own personal sanctification. Mm. But what a joy this will continue to be as we can communally do this, right? Mm-hmm. If we can catch ourselves and when as a community, we can kind of, do that.
Can I add one more thought to that, Alexis?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So there's that part about us catching ourselves, you know, and humbling ourselves. But then there's this other part, you know, when you're talking about the community dynamic of catching each other doing good, you know, you know, Paul frames it this way. He says, encourage one another and build one another up. Don't tear each other down.
Yes.
Meaning that, you know, in the same way that we need, you know, 10 good words from Christ in order to be able to deal with one, you know, aspect of guilt, shame, or regret, we need 10 positive, good identity words from Christ. In the same way, we set ourselves up in community to be able to remove the specks from one another's eyes, or as, you know, Galatians 6 says, you know, you who are spiritual should restore gently those who are caught in transgression. There's that word gentleness again. But in order to have the kind of climate in a community, you know, we've got to pronounce 10 life-giving words over one another for every, you know, constructive, redemptive critique we might bring to the table, if that makes sense. So
yeah, it's good. And I think that the more we do that, right, the more that we will learn to trust each other with the critique. Mm-hmm. Right. When we're confident that someone can see us when we're trying, that someone can see our hearts through our actions, when we can see that, then we can trust one another more to point out when the criticisms come, because then it even feels like it's coming from a more loving place, right? When you feel seen by that person, and you can say, I know that they see me, not just my mistakes. They see me and they see my character. And they see the things that I'm trying to do and the ways I'm trying to be more like Christ. They see that. And so when you come with a critique, then it's easier to receive, right? When you feel seen and loved, like you mentioned before, at the same time by them.
I mean, the principles of parenting really do apply to the principles of community. Mm-hmm. You know, Dan Allender has this great summary of what constitutes life-giving parenting. And he basically says that kids are asking two questions all the time. And the first question of their parents, first question is, do you love me? Mm-hmm. And the second one is, can I get away with whatever I want? And as long as we're continually establishing a climate where there's the unquestionably the answer to the first question is yes, mm-hmm. and unquestionably the answer to the second question is no, mm-hmm. You know, the kids are going to grow up, you know, feeling, you know, loved and given proper life-giving, healthy boundaries, etc. But I think it's really important to remember that child never leaves us. You know, we are all still the person we were born to be. And Jesus even calls us back into that space, right? You've got to receive the kingdom like a child. You've got to become a child again in order to receive the kingdom and to be fully human. And you know, that line in the movie Wonder, be kind because every person you meet is fighting a hard hidden battle. That's just another way of saying everyone's still a child on the inside, right? You know, my wife notices this, like whenever we would visit our parents or my parents' home, she said, you know, you just change. You become a different person when you step into your parents' house and you know, for good or for ill, you change and become a different person. And what I realized as she said that is I become the kid I was in junior high. Mm-hmm. When I walk back into my parents' house at age 50, you know, and so just to be aware of that there's no such person, you know, everybody is overwhelmed and under encouraged. Just go into relationships and community with that awareness that just like you, everyone is overwhelmed and under encouraged on some level.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you can, I'll ask one kind of final, or give us one kind of final prompt, and then I'll let you take us where you want to end our time together. But the beginning, or the subtitle of your book, is Our Secret Weapon in an Age of Us Against Them. Mm-hmm. And as we record this, we are a week away, less than a week away from when the election will be finished. We're at the end of October right now. And the phrasing that I've heard, and I'm not alone, in the last months is basically, where's the unity? We're so divided right now. We want unity, and unity is kind of a buzzword right now. But in this age of us against them, I'm wondering, because the thought I had after reading your book wasn't unity necessarily. There is an us against them right now. That's for sure. We feel division in a lot of different spheres of life. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But when I thought maybe unity isn't even the right word, but I feel like some people are saying unity and meaning homogeneous. We're all just going to look the same, right? So right now we're divided, but what we want is unity, which means, or AKA, we're all going to look the same. But in this gentleness and in our secret weapon in an age of us versus them, when I put the book down, I thought, I can see the division for sure. That doesn't take any kind of special lens to see the division. It's there. But it didn't look like some call to some magical or symbolic or evasive unity. It felt more like, to me as a reader, it felt more like a call to compassionate relationship, which is not the same as being the same or having the same or doing the same or saying the same.
Right.
So I guess talk to the us versus them part of this, and what is the goal, or what does that look like?
Yeah. It looks like love across the lines of difference. Not love in the absence of difference, but love across the lines of difference. There's a big difference between unity and uniformity. Uniformity is when, you know, we become sort of robotic, right? Yeah. Uniformity is what happens in an echo chamber. Uniformity is what happens in a community, or in some cases in a nation. The more tyrannical the nation's leadership is, uniformity is, you know, fall in line or else you will pay. That's the case in some, you know, places of worship as well, unfortunately. But unity is what Paul is a word that Paul used to describe what Christ has paved the way for between Jews and Gentiles, who were very different ethnically. They were very different in their traditions, in their politics, you know, in their socio-political, you know, sort of viewpoints. You know, they're very different and coming from very different places and backgrounds and histories. And yet he called them to be one in Christ Jesus, right? He says there's one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of us all. And so unity is about the gospel of Jesus Christ transcending those things that have potential to divide us, which, you know, I'll tip my hand a little bit in the book. My theory is that the resources really do not exist in the world outside of Jesus Christ for true unity or for true diversity, for a true, not just tolerance, because what tolerance is just a thinly veiled form of hatred and contempt. But truly love and curiosity and mutual learning and mutual rubbing off on each other. You know, sort of this complementary dynamic of relationship where we value and treasure our differences because we learn and grow from them, and also have our rough edges, you know, shaved off as we engage with those who come from different perspectives under Christ. But I don't think those resources exist outside of what Christ has accomplished through his life, death, burial, and resurrection. And you know, as a 21st century American white guy, I am constantly trying to remind myself that my hope rests on the shoulders of a brown-skinned first century Middle Eastern Jewish man who was a refugee during his childhood, who was homeless during his adult life, and who died as a political enemy, you know, someone who was regarded as an enemy of the state of Rome politically, and like as a failed revolutionary, right? At least that's what they thought. My hope rests on somebody who couldn't be more different than me, mm-hmm. and yet who told his disciples, "I want you to go to the ends of the earth, just like I want you to go to Jerusalem and bring them in." And I'm part of that them group, right? America has never been the center of the Christian story. We've always been on the outskirts, on the periphery. We are the ends of the earth that Jesus talks about. So with that in mind, it ought to be, at least I think, an intriguing pursuit and a motivating, compelling pursuit to learn Christ through people who are different than me, who see things differently than me politically, or, you know, ethnically or economically, who have a different experience than me, and yet who have a shared faith in Christ. But to your question, a gentle answer is a lot more about becoming the kinds of people that can contribute to a more unifying reality between different people groups. Like I said at the beginning of the interview, the book that I wrote, Jesus Outside the Lines, is more of a practical, here's what it can look like to engage across differences on subjects like race, like politics, like, sexuality, I'm forgetting a lot of the chapters. I wrote that one so long ago, but that's more the practical outworking of what can happen when, you know, the heart is cultivated in a way that a gentle answer tries to lead readers, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you so much. Scott, what would you leave us with what question did I not ask? What did you not get the opportunity to say that you would want to encourage us? And maybe we can even phrase it this way. This is going to air between Thanksgiving and Christmas. This is going to air after the election, but before 2020 is in the rearview mirror. What words of encouragement could you leave us with now?
Well, I mean, this has been a dumpster fire of a year. And, the season that you're describing is the beginning of Advent, which was about Jesus coming into the world, which created a dumpster fire of a situation for Joseph and Mary and everybody around him. The coming of Christ led to a mass genocide from Herod. They called him Herod the Great. They call it the slaughter of the innocents, where every boy under the age of two was murdered because of Herod's decree, because of a rumor that he heard that people are saying that this young, you know, son of Joseph and Mary from Nazareth is the Messiah, right? And so he was a refugee, right? Like, conditions were terrible. What we've experienced in 2020 would have been like a paradise to what Christ and the people around Christ were going through at that time, which is to say that what Isaiah wrote centuries before in Isaiah chapter 9, which we hear read during every Advent season, if we identify with a local church, which I want to say that all of your listeners who belong to Jesus Christ, they also need to belong to his bride. Okay. Yes. So, like, you can't have a relationship with me if you don't want a relationship with my wife. Okay. So that's kind of a sidetrack, but get back to the point here. We'll hear Isaiah 9 read in churches all over the world. And Isaiah says of Jesus, the son of David, to us a child is born, right? And so he's born into these awful set of circumstances. To us a child is born. And then it goes on to say, and the government will be on his shoulders, and of the increase of his government and of his reign, there will be no end. And so my encouragement to your listeners, as well as to myself, is no matter how bad it gets, and this has been a bad, bad, bad year for a lot of us, no matter how bad it gets, your best days are always ahead of you. You know, I heard somebody say, don't you just miss living in precedented times? Can't you wait? You know, because we live in all these unprecedented times, right? I saw this picture on Instagram. It was a picture of four Johnny on the Spots. They were on fire. And the caption said, if 2020 were a scented candle, it would look like this. Murder hornets, a brain eating virus in Texas, an asteroid the size of the Empire State Building headed toward the Earth, the economy crashing, people losing their jobs, all the COVID numbers, churches, losing so many people and, touring artists not allowed to tour anymore. Just everything's just crazy, right? It's been a terrible, terrible year for a lot of people. The good days are not the good old days. The good days are still the days that are ahead. This will pass. And Jesus, even in the midst of all this, says is making all things new, including us. But we like Isaiah also said, no eye has seen, no ear has heard what marvelous things that the Lord has in store for them. And, Isaiah was one who was, in his earthly ministry, nobody listened to him. They despised him. They opposed him. And eventually they sought him in two. That's how he died. He never saw the fruit of his ministry. And yet Isaiah becomes the most quoted book from the Old Testament in the New Testament. We sing from Isaiah every year in Handel's Messiah and all those wonderful prophecies about Christ. They're coming true as history unfolds. And they're all going to completely come true, which means that, like Lord of the Rings says, everything sad will come untrue because the gospel will become more visibly and tangibly truer and truer and truer and truer as history continues to unfold. And so take heart, he has overcome the world by coming up from the dead. And so he will take all of this death, mourning and crying and pain, and he'll swallow it up in victory. Revelation 21 is another really encouraging passage of scripture along these things, but the future is always bright. Best days are always ahead of us, and so never forget that. That would be my encouragement in a crappy year like this one.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I just I think I'm just gonna say I feel pastored right now. So thank you, because I feel like we need that, right? We need that. We all need that pastoral care. We need those words. We need those words in our lives right now. So thank you for sharing them with us. Where can we grab the book, and where can we find you on social media?
Sure. The book, as always, it's cheapest on Amazon. The price is lowest there. But you can find me at scottsauls.com, just my first and last name.com. And that'll give you information about the church I pastor, about my books, and also people can subscribe. I do a weekly blog that goes to people's inbox, and people can subscribe to that there and a few other things. So just my website will, it kind of consolidates everything I'm involved with.
Perfect. I'll link to it. And I'll just put it out there and say, if you are on Twitter, you need to be following Scott on Twitter. If you are on Instagram too, but I actually got on Twitter because I was on Instagram, have been on Instagram for so long. And then I found out a lot of the authors and pastors that I love to see on Instagram are, the Twitter is where it's at for them. And, so I'd say you are one of the, encouraging posts that come through my Twitter feed. So when you guys are looking for encouragement in this dumpster fire of a year, follow Scott on Twitter and you'll get it there. So thank you so much for coming on, Scott. I appreciate your time and your words and your message for us today.
Thank you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.